Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
With advances in machine learning and the application of AI, we're starting to see, we're starting to train those digital tools to be able to do what humans used to do. We're able to handle it more because we're able to train these ML machine learning systems and AI to recognize features and draw out useful information and present those insights that we're also interested in.
Welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. For some time, I've been ruminating about how data has and continues to change the aerospace and aviation sector. From megabytes to terabytes, from bytes per second to gigabytes per second, volume, transfer speeds, and depth have all massively changed and innovated the sector. Here is what Caitlin, an AI voice generator, had to say reading an AI-generated script about data in aerospace.
The use of data in aerospace and aviation has become increasingly crucial for enhancing safety, efficiency, and overall performance. Data-driven technologies and strategies are employed across various aspects of the aerospace and aviation industries, from aircraft design and manufacturing to flight operations and maintenance. Here are some key areas where data is extensively used. Aircraft design and manufacturing, such as computer-aided design. Flight operations for weather data, air traffic management, and flight tracking. Maintenance and predictive maintenance for health monitoring systems and predictive analytics. And space exploration for mission planning and telemetry data. Overall, data-driven approaches play a pivotal role in shaping the aerospace and aviation industries, leading to improved safety, efficiency, and innovation.
We'll have a few episodes that will come out over the next month or two that specifically challenges our guests to talk about how data, the cloud, AI, and machine learning are changing the aerospace sector. We actually started with our last episode, where we talked to Max, the co-founder of X-Wing, about their autonomous cargo Cessna Caravan flights. Today's episode comes from the Harwell campus in Oxfordshire in the UK, where we talk to the Satellite Applications Catapult, who are at the heart of the satellite revolution in the UK, driving take-up of space technology to shape and sustain our future world.
I'm Gary Cannon. I'm the Space Segment Lead at the Satellite Applications Catapult. I come from a spacecraft design background, anything that we do at the Catapult, whether whoever we're talking to or any projects that require hardware that goes into space, I'm usually involved because I'm familiar with the life cycle of that hardware, everything from concept through to test and delivery and operations, and all the design processes and the manufacturing processes and the quality that has to go behind all of this. Yeah. I'm familiar with that. So it's a useful place to be able to bring some of that like experience to new entrants to the space sector, because we get a lot of that here. We get a lot of people asking, how do we get this into space? So that's where I come in.
And you talk about your experience. Where was that gained?
So I started off after university. I went to what was Astrium, it's now Airbus, up in Stevenage. They were making the big geostationary spacecraft. Yeah. I worked in the test facility.
one of the test facilities up in Stevenage, and moved through a few departments within Astrium or Airbus. And then I moved to Surrey Satellites, Surrey Satellite Technology Limited in Guildford, to become a spacecraft designer. We called them lead mechanical engineers there, where I designed I believe it's the first UK constellation.
Wow.
We built five
rapid-eye
spacecraft for low Earth orbit, LEO, Earth observation capability. Yeah. So that was good fun building that. And then I moved on to help. I was part of the core team for the Galileo navigation system.
Right.
So that was great as well, working across Europe with both of those roles.
And what does the Catapult do for suppliers like Airbus and Surrey Satellites?
So we're the great thing about the Catapult is the convening power. We're a knowledge hub, a neutral trusted entity. People come to us to ask, how can we implement this work? How can we get this study, this academic work into commercialization or industrialization? And because we have NDAs with everybody, it allows us to have a great picture of the whole sector, everything from the space hardware that I'm interested in all the way through the value chain to the people processing the data from space to the end user who's actually using that data.
Yeah.
So we get a lot of people from across the sector coming to us, and we all work across our departments to understand what that whole value chain is and how we can put people together to make the UK as good as it can be based on all of that potential.
Now, you mentioned data there, and obviously we've got a really keen interest in this episode to talk about data and data-driven solutions. In that time of your career, a lot's probably changed, and we talk about the cloud and the use of all sorts of data sources and big data. How have you seen that change in the last decade or so?
From my point of view, it's very definitely been on the digitalization of build processes and test processes.
Right.
When I first started designing spacecraft, we did use digital tools, obviously. There was a lot of computer-aided design and finite element analysis and that kind of thing. So, but we also use paper-based reporting for a lot of what we did, a lot of the build processes. And this was, must be about 15 years ago now. We started saying it would be better if we could use digital tools to get rid of some of this paper. And, of course, it creates that backup trail. You can always go back and find the file as opposed to a piece of paper that gets dog-eared and eventually destroyed. on that side of things, the digitalization of build and test processes and all sorts of other things like tracking back to the requirements as well.
Yeah.
There's some amazing tools out there for making sure that what you've got at the end actually conforms to the requirements that were specified at the start. So digitalization on that point has been great, but by far the biggest side of the sector is the data that comes back to Earth from space. So all of the Earth observation data from a couple of thousand spacecraft in low Earth orbit, producing reams of data. I've heard the term data lake because there's so much information. Now, of course, some of that is some of those images that some of those spacecraft were taking are over cloud. So, they're trying to look at the land, but they can't see it because they're using visual instruments that are blocked by cloud.
Yep.
So there's a lot of data that's essentially useless. You can't see the land because you can see the cloud. But of course, because that data is saved now, other people are finding different applications for that. So they can look at the top of clouds and start to see patterns across, the shapes of clouds and the density of clouds and the amount of particulates that clouds are holding and rainwater and that kind of thing. And you can start to develop applications based on what was originally thought of as useless data. And indeed, what we're trying to do at the moment is build spacecraft that have processing capabilities on board such that they can recognize if the data is useless and discard that before it's downlinked. Because, of course, data's great. Data's, data's the new oil and all that kind of thing. But if we can't use that oil, then it's no good. So this processing on board is autonomously filtering out what is deemed to be not great data. Yeah. So, for example, clouds. If we, you know, if we really actually just wanted to see the health of fields, but we're taking pictures when it was cloudy, then the processors on board can, they're starting to get to a point where they can recognize the clouds themselves, delete that data, and then only downlink the data from the spacecraft to the Earth that is useful.
Right, exactly.
Of course, there's costs involved with that downlink. So,
yeah.
So there's commercial models involved here as well.
Now, there's masses of equipment of various ages, types, shapes, and capabilities. And we want to come back to that whole issue in a while. But as that has all grown, as those constellations have grown, are humans and the technology we're attempting to apply here capable of dealing with all of that data before we can make it of use?
Usable, and, yeah, exactly, and gain insights from it. That's ultimately what we're trying to do here, because yes is the short answer. Previously, data was very, I use the term mandrolic, it was humans that were looking at the data. They had to adjust the data, filter the data to make sure that it was providing the right information, because the raw files that you get down look like what's it called, snow or static. You know, there's a lot of filtering that you have to do on the various like bands, and like there's a lot of correction. That was all done by humans to get it to a point where you could actually see a recognizable picture of landmass or across the sea or coasts or whatever it was. So that is becoming more autonomous. But also in the past, and I'd probably have to defer to some of my due information scientist colleagues here, but in the past, humans also looked at that data to see the patterns.
Yeah.
And I forget which way around it was. I think either humans are very good at recognizing patterns and computers aren't.
Yeah.
Or the other way around. I think humans are good at recognizing patterns. We can look at the data and say, oh, this has changed from here to there, or I can see the same geological features here and there. So this is where humans were good. But of course, with advances in machine learning and the application of AI, we're starting to train those digital tools to be able to do what humans used to do.
Yeah.
So yes, all of that data that's coming down, we're able to handle it more because we're able to train these ML machine learning systems and AI to recognize features and draw out useful information and present those insights that we're also interested in.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to come back to machine learning in a little bit, but I want to hear a little bit more about a satellite you were involved in earlier this year.
Yep.
In the maritime arena. Tell us a bit of background and how that came about.
So that came about because we were approached by a company. That's probably not quite right. So the Catapult runs an in-orbit demonstration program. And the point of that program is to help people get their service or capability into space to realize a particular business model that they put forward.
Yeah.
Now, this program was quite popular a few years ago because the neutral trusted entity status of the Catapult allowed a lot of people to come to us, and we wouldn't confuse them with, you know, you have to do this on the space and you have to do that in space. So we got a lot of people. So we eventually had to make that into a competition. And in this case, the company called Horizon Technologies won that competition to get their payload onto this, what we call a 3U CubeSat. 3U is basically, it's a 30 centimeter long.
Right, okay.
It's pretty small. The reason they wanted to get their technology into space is because they had similar technology that they flew on aircraft. And they would fly it over areas of interest, should we say, and it would pick up RF, radio frequency signals from that area of interest. And they could determine where different entities were based on the RF emissions and the location of those emissions. And they realized, Horizon Technologies realized, that if they could get that technology into space, they could cover a much greater area with much more repeatability from a time point of view. So they developed their payload with some of their colleagues in the States, and we provided the platform with our colleagues up in Scotland at Clyde Space. And the payload and the platform came together. We sorted all of the interfacing out and the testing and the operations so that Horizon could get their capability into low Earth orbit, and they could use it from use the same technology that, you know, this RF sensing technology from space. And they can use that for all sorts of dual use capabilities. And one of the big ones really is piracy. Because there's a lot of activity that happens at sea because there's nobody around. But all of those boats use radar to navigate, and they use sat phones or some other forms of communication.
Oh, I understand.
All of them are RF, right? Yeah. So some of them are quite smart. They turn off their radar, so they can't be seen. But of course, we can. They still need to communicate with their colleagues. So this payload from Horizon can pick up those sat phone emissions, and they can start to pinpoint the location of nefarious activity.
Okay. And I when I was doing my research, the term triage of maritime transponders was a term that was used. What did you mean by that in terms of a data-driven solution?
Yeah, so there is a lot of every ship over 300 tons has to broadcast in what they call an AIS. That's the automatic identification signal.
Yeah.
And that is used for navigation and tracking of these vessels. And I know there's various levels of AIS. Some of them simply say position and direction. Then other levels of AIS show the size of the boat, the turning circle of the boat. You know, so basically it's used for collision avoidance and management of maritime traffic. So if you have boats that have turned off their transponders, then you've got dark vessels operating in potentially busy shipping lanes, or even if they're out at sea somewhere completely quiet, you know, you still need to be able to bring all that information together so you can effectively manage that traffic and police the traffic as well. So the triaging of information is it's another level of like RF maritime observation or maritime observation based on RF signals that allows those people managing maritime traffic to do their job better. And of course, all of that, the signals are data, right? It's this, I am here. This is my name. This is my position. This is my direction. This is my speed. And all of that data, there's thousands of vessels out there. You know?
Yeah.
So it's got to be a computer driven solution that helps to manage all of that.
Now, hoovering up all that significant data just must be an absolute monster in terms of how that data is brought up, analyzed, and retransmitted. What are we talking about in terms of data traffic? Is it, how does that operate? Is it, are we talking megabytes? Are we talking gigabytes? Are we talking?
Yeah. So, the combination, so getting an RF signal and then sending down the fact that you received an RF signal is easy. That's in the byte range, is, you know, very low level data. But it's no good just having that data. I found a signal. Great. Where is it? When did it happen? So it's all of that backup data. So these signals that the IOD-3 or AmbraSat mission was picking up is combined with GPS and timing signals so that the satellite can respond to say, I found this RF signal and I was here when I found it, and it was this time of day night or whatever. So now they can use that geolocation information to help pinpoint, you know, these vessels. But of course, it's all of that data that adds to those couple of bytes of RF information. So once all that's added up, you get into the order of, it was around about, I think it was around about 50 gigabytes per day for this one spacecraft.
Right.
So you multiply that by, there's the order of 5,000, the number keeps changing depending on which report I read, but there's the order of 5,000 active satellites up there. So if you multiply, and this one, IOD-3, is a relatively small spacecraft. It's just a demonstrator.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a, there's a vast amount of data going up and down.
And, you know, as we, as some people see from things like Starlink, this is very immediate. You know, this data is traveling at rapid rates of knots. Is speed of transmission an issue for some of these satellites?
Yeah, absolutely. So we refer to that as latency. So the traditionally communication spacecraft are out, I say out at geostationary, that's 36,000 kilometers away from the Earth. So that's quite a long way to go, even at the speed of light for an RF signal. Yeah. It still takes, you know, a finite amount of time to get out to geostationary and back to geostationary as well, back to Earth. That's why constellations like Starlink and the OneWeb constellation, that's why there's interest, because they're a lot closer. These spacecraft are the order of, they're in low Earth orbit, so they're the order of 600 to 2,000 kilometers away, so much closer.
Right.
The problem is, of course, they don't stay over one point on Earth. The geostationary spacecraft, the name comes from the fact that it stays over the same point, whereas the LEO spacecraft, low Earth orbit spacecraft, travel much faster. You'll have heard speeds of like 8 kilometers per second. Mm. So because they're much closer, the signals can be received and sent back to Earth much quicker. So that helps from a communication point of view.
Right.
But it does mean that they've got to pass the signals potentially back through the rest of the constellation or to a different ground station. So there's more infrastructure to get through with the LEO communication spacecraft.
Right.
But because they're much closer, it works out as better.
Right. It's okay. Faster. Okay. And just coming back to our maritime solution, I want to, when we were creating that, obviously there's a need and a desire for particular elements of specific information. Does creating something like that unearth opportunity, should we say, for use of that data for something else? Is it capable of being used for other reasons? Do we find that ability to use satellite transmitted data in other ways very often?
Yeah, and that's the entire reason behind the satellite applications Catapult, because people come to us with an idea. Mm. Can we use this data to do that? And we'll help them look into that requirement and see if there's something that they can do. And absolutely, there's been so many examples of using satellite data that was intended for one purpose for a completely different purpose.
Yeah.
For example, there's a lot of work on reflectometry at the moment, and the spacecraft that work in this field, they use the reflected signals from the GPS satellite. It's a bit of a misnomer. That's the American system, the Global Navigation Satellite System, the GNSS systems. Yeah. They broadcast these timing signals, and they bounce off various elements, for example, the sea surface. Nobody ever thought of using that bounce signal because it was almost wasted RF energy in a way. But there are companies out there that are building spacecraft that can receive these bounced signals, and they can use that to determine wave height, wave conditions, sea currents, and of course that feeds into understanding about weather systems and, you know, whether a particular passage is clear or dangerous for vessels. So that's one example of using a signal for something else completely.
Yeah.
And that happens all over the place. All of these low Earth observation spacecraft, they go up with one or several intentions in mind. But once that data has been produced, other people start to hear about the data and think, can I use it for this? Can I use it for that? And that's the applications are so numerous. It's incredible.
So putting you on the spot then a little bit, Gary, with that, there is whatever it is, the number 5,000 plus there's lots of other bits and pieces flying around. Why do we need to keep sending more and more satellites into space to give us information and to help us live a new life? What, given all the environmental pressures on us all at the moment, why are we still trying to harvest more and more data from
That's a super pertinent question. That's coming up all over the place at the moment, because of course it does take energy and therefore carbon to get spacecraft into space.
Yeah.
But if we didn't have spacecraft in the first place, we wouldn't understand the level of pollution that we're creating. Of course, all of these spacecraft are giving us an idea of the extent of the ice caps, the CFCs in the air, and all that. So to answer your question directly, it's the improving technology. So obviously as we go through time, our capability and understanding of the environment and the atmosphere, and what we want to know about our activities increases.
Yeah.
So we launch spacecraft over and again because we get new technology on board, and we can see more things, we can understand more things, and we can create a better level of life from those capabilities. And of course, the GNSS capabilities, what they provide across the entire human globe is fascinating, the amount of applications that GNSS and timing signals in particular have. But when a spacecraft has been built nowadays, the licensing authorities around the world, and in particular in the UK, where the Civil Aviation Authority is leading the charge on sustainability of space, we're not allowed to just build a spacecraft because we want to.
Yeah.
There has to be a purpose for it, or we have to do an assessment on whether there's existing data that we can use without launching a spacecraft, because we understand that the sustainability of space is incredibly important. We use it, as you've said, for our everyday lives. And if we don't look after that space environment, then we're not going to be able to use it in future generations.
Okay.
So there's a lot of work going on for the serviceability of spacecraft, the recycling even of spacecraft in space. We're looking at capability where we can take parts off existing spacecraft and melt them down so that we can use them for future applications.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what we do at the moment is either bring low Earth orbit spacecraft down into the atmosphere so they burn up and therefore get out of the way of a new spacecraft, or geostationary spacecraft, we send them up, we send them even higher to what we call a graveyard orbit. So they're out of the way.
Okay.
Ready for more new technology.
Now, I know we weren't planning to talk about situational awareness, but let me ask you about that. How can we use the information and the data we have on the debris, as well as the operating, as well as the graveyard pieces of equipment up there, to change that? Is there hope?
Yes, there absolutely is. Yeah. So there's a few terms bouncing around: space situational awareness, space domain awareness, and space traffic management. And of course, there's acronyms for all of them, as there is across the space sector. Space situational awareness is the study of what's in orbit. And so if we have a better understanding, and there are, of course, several entities tracking space objects, both active and defunct or debris, rocket bodies, dead satellites, pieces of satellites. We're tracking everything from down to the sub 5 millimeter range. And there's millions of pieces, obviously, of the smaller stuff. So we need to know where those tiny particles are, as well as the bigger ones.
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's Solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
once we understand that, and obviously, again, the better our understanding of those pieces of debris, the better we can start to think about what we call space traffic management. Excuse me. And that is a burgeoning field where we start to look at what's out there, how it's moving, and how it's moving relative to other spacecraft.
Yeah.
And we do this now, but we can tell if two spacecraft are going to come close to each other. We call that conjunction. So right. There are companies out there that perform these conjunction analyses. And we can then tell the operators of those spacecraft that you're going to get a bit too close to another spacecraft. So that's where we can start to say that somebody needs to do a maneuver, an orbital maneuver, to either raise their altitude or change their inclination or something like that, so that you can avoid that other body. So, yes, there is hope. There are people working on space traffic management, and there's a lot of work on space situation awareness and space domain awareness as well.
Right, okay. So let's talk about the future then. How do you see satellite technology evolving? What's your feel for what's going to happen next?
So obviously we've come an incredibly long way from Sputnik to the capabilities that we have now, where we have AI on board spacecraft determining whether data is usable or not, and all the processing that goes on board communication spacecraft. There's been some fantastic leaps in the capability of satellite technology. The next thing, in my opinion, is the building of structures in space. So the Catapult is working on a project called Space-Based Solar Power, in conjunction with it. There's a big consortium, as you can imagine, that's working on this concept of space-based solar power, where we're building solar farms in space. These solar farms are going to be so huge, you can't build them on Earth and then launch them on one rocket. They're going to have to be assembled in space. So to do that, we're going to need robotics to be able to pull the pieces together, maybe even manufacture pieces in space, and then move them from a construction orbit to an operational orbit.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a lot of propulsion requirements, a lot of attitude and orbit control requirements, and what we call OTVs, orbital transfer vehicles, where these are vehicles that take equipment from one orbit to another.
Yeah.
So the ability to, the technology required to do that is absolutely required. So we're working on that at the moment. We don't have it quite yet. But I know there's a lot of people across the sector, both in the UK and internationally, working on this, and it's absolutely fascinating. But what comes alongside that is some of the regulatory requirements. Because as I was just saying before, with the conjunction analysis, you try and keep spacecraft apart.
Yeah.
Because when they come together, they create debris. That's a bad thing. Whereas now we're purposefully trying to bring spacecraft together to be able to literally assemble them in space. So the regulatory requirements behind this are interesting as well. So how do we build on that?
None of that can be done. You mentioned robotics. I'm getting the feel there'll be less human intervention. So the use of AI, machine learning comes into the equation, because there may be things that we rely on the spacecraft or whatever type they are to do the jobs, the manufacturing, the coordination, creates even more data and technology to drive what we need to do. Yes. Will there come a time that AI can do that sort of thing on its own in space?
I'm sure. It's probably a bit naive to say that it won't be able to, considering the speed at which AI has been developed in the past few years.
Yeah.
But of course, what we have to take little steps to get to that point. So what's happening at the moment is the development of haptic capability in space.
What's haptic?
So that's when you get feedback from a robotic arm.
Right.
So when a robotic grappler grabs something else, the haptic capability allows you to feel the force and the pressure of that robotic gripper on something else. So at the moment, haptic capability is deemed to be the first step. You know, can I grab this other spacecraft, and how much can I grab it before I start to feel something giving way? Or perhaps I need to feel the spin rate of another spacecraft. And if I can feel that, then a human is going to be able to process that faster than a computer at the moment.
Yeah.
Because we kind of need to understand that interaction between two spacecraft and the robotics that are connecting them before we can tell a computer how to understand it.
Yeah.
So the first stage is going to be in development of understanding the environment in which these two spacecraft come together. Once we have that, then it's absolutely feasible to say that, you know, we can apply machine learning to say you should expect to see this much force. If you get more than this force, what do you do next? And AI will come into that, I'm sure.
Right. So to wrap up then, Gary, where do you see the sector going? What do you think short-term and medium-term, long-term horizons will be for satellite technology and the information we need to make our lives?
Okay. So, yeah, the short-term is going to be, we're going to continue to develop these imaging capabilities for Earth observation and communication technologies. Because we can absolutely understand the benefit that that space-derived information provides to us here on Earth. So we're going to see a continuation of those instruments that can see that and the capability of spacecraft to support those instruments. Then we're going to move into this in-orbit autonomy, like we were just talking about. We call that in-orbit servicing, manufacturing and assembly, basically robotics in space. And orbital transfers. And with all of that, we get an increased amount of data. So this haptic technology, that's data. You know, there has to be some communication, and that communication path is data. So that's going to build on the data requirements of the spacecraft and obviously the ground stations as well. And then, of course, we're looking at extraterrestrial habitation. So lunar habitation, we're all familiar with Mr. Musk's desires to set up facilities on Mars, that's going to require a variety of data and solutions that I can't conceive. That's the great thing about what we do here at the Catapult, because we can start the ball rolling, but it's everybody else that comes in and creates some of those solutions.
Yeah,
and those solutions, everything's going to require data. So there's already a communications spacecraft orbiting the moon, for example. So that's in place, ready to transmit data to and from any of our human colleagues that are going to the moon. And of course, any robots that are going to be on the moon as well, doing their thing.
And just to wrap up then, I mean, when I was younger, bytes and megabytes were big things. Now we throw gigabytes away as if they're, a bit of this and that. I mean, how much further can we go? How much?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, isn't it? How much more data do we need, and how much can we transfer?
Yeah.
So of course we've moved away from the copper wire to fiber optics, and indeed just say that's another application of space manufacturing. There are companies in the UK that are making fiber optics because it's a much more pure environment. Because of the lack of gravity, you can create more efficient fiber optics. But you're not going to run a fiber optic cable from the moon to the Earth. That's still going to have to be over an RF capability. But the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU, they understand the increasing needs of transmitted data. So they are looking at, they license the ability to use certain frequencies. And here at the Catapult, we're working on a project where we're looking at reusing certain frequencies as well. And of course, reusing it in a more efficient manner. And that's again where digital technologies come in with the whole compression side of things. So
fascinating.
It is, isn't it?
It really is an exciting time. Just before we wrap up then, Gary, social media. Are you on social media? Can people follow you?
I'm on LinkedIn. Yeah. I don't really have the time or to do Twitter or anything like that. But I post occasionally on LinkedIn.
Okay. And we can find the Satellite Catapult on all the major platforms.
Yeah. Yeah, my marketing colleagues here at the Catapult are much better at social media than I am. So yeah, they're on all of the platforms.
And we'll put links to those in the show notes. So Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure meeting you.
We'll bring you more episodes with data-led interest, and I'm excited about the guests we've got lined up. But that's it for this episode. Before I go, I wanted to thank those loyal listeners who have engaged with us and left reviews. If you're one of those who's not, please, I ask you to reach out and do this for us. If we want Extended to continue, we have to increase our listener engagement. If you don't, we drop further down the listings, and from a personal point of view, carrying on will be debatable. So thanks. We're keen to hear your comments and feedback on this episode, so do contact us on social media or by email, or of course, give us 5 stars on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can find me at Mascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the Extended Twitter, Facebook, Threads and Instagram feeds. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.